Hello and welcome to the Writer's Block. Yes, people, it's the Writer's Block. It's a Sunday. It's 10 p.m. here in lovely Skopje, Macedonia. Now, we are not streaming from our usual location, but we're still within the sprawling metropolis. In fact, we are nearer the center of the urban heat island effect. So if I have a heart attack live on air, it's going to happen today and not some other day. And with me here tonight, I have Anthony Bavaria, and he's a writer for Countercurrents. Anthony, how are you doing tonight?
Good. And like I said before, thank you very much for having me on.
Well, I'm glad to have you on. And pretty soon, our audience will have the chance to bask in your brilliance. I do believe you're one of the more insightful writers we have. And this is a catch for the block, certainly. But before we get into that, I'm afraid we have some crass financial concerns to address. Now, people, you may not know this if you're tuning in for the first time, but we are having a fundraiser at Countercurrents. That's right. We're having a fundraiser. It means we're raising funds, and you can donate funds to us through Entropy. Now, you can use Entropy to ask us questions. They call them super chats. So you send money, and attached to the money is a question for me, for Anthony, or maybe you just want to comment something about what a good job we're doing. I always like getting those very low effort for me. But, you know, I put in the effort for you. So if you want to, I will answer your questions, and I will be happy to do it, you know. You will answer questions and you will be happy. That's what Mr. Schwab said to me. And you can also use Cash App. Now, you can use Cash App to donate to Countercurrents. You can't ask questions with Cash App. So if you just want to give us money out of the goodness of your heart because you believe in our cause, I don't know, stranger things have happened, you can just use Cash App for that. Now, there's some other ways. There's more ways. There's all sorts of ways for you to donate money to Countercurrents, because you know what they say. If you want to, who was it? You want to get something, you got to ask for it first. So you can give us lemons on DLive. Lemons, ice creams, ninjets, ninja genies. Oh, even the humble diamond is accepted over on DLive. Now, those tokens, they are, I believe, a form of cryptocurrency, but ultimately just a token exchangeable for fiat currency. And you could donate through DLive. And you can also send us a tip through Entropy. Now, on Entropy, you can either give us Library Coin, which is their own homegrown cryptocurrency, or just plain old American dollars. And I think it's just dollars for now. I have not seen a different currency being donated through Odyssey. But who knows? Maybe we will have our first euro donation on Odyssey tonight. Maybe our first pound donation. I know we have people in Japan watching, so I want to see that yen sign over on Odyssey. Please do me this solid and let's conduct this experiment. And of course, you can use MoonPay. MoonPay, you can just swipe your credit card and it transforms your fiat currency into cryptocurrency. And it goes into our crypto wallet here on Countercurrents. And in case you ever forget this, we have the banner blinking underneath my portrait here and Anthony's avatar. And of course, our courageous and indomitable moderators will be posting these links in chat all night so you can more easily support Countercurrents. Now, those are all the direct ways. There is an indirect way, and you can do that by purchasing the fine products of our sponsor, Alyaska Chaga. And here I am sipping the flagship product, Alyaska Chaga Tea. And this is interesting. I think this is the first time that I've got the actual chaga chunk still in there. I'm going to keep soaking it, right? Because I want that rich, thick taste. This is the chaga chunk. It's actually pretty soggy and black now. Maybe I shouldn't be showing it. But it is probably some of the most delicious tea I've ever had in my life. And it's apparently also healthy for you. It's got antioxidants. And it just smells divine. What can I tell you? Chaga nationalism. In every forest, there are mulberry mushrooms. Sometimes they are known as chaga. Marcin Marcinkiewicz Tesak, a very wise man. Check out the article on chaga nationalism, too, because we look to the chaga for your political organizational needs. Well, I think that's enough crass financial concerns for one night. And we have a very special guest with us here tonight, Anthony. This is your first time on the Writer's Block, and indeed, I think this is the first time you're ever doing a full-length show with someone. You've been on various birthday and party streams, but why don't you introduce yourself to our audience and introduce yourself as if there are people who have never heard of you in the chat, although I do believe such a travesty is inconceivable.
Well, thank you very much for all the kind words, and again, I appreciate you having me on, and like you said, yeah, this is my first time doing like a full like solo show for this. Like you said, my pen name there is Anthony Bavaria. I've only been writing for Countercurrents for about a year now. I've been reading for a long time, I guess the better part of a decade. And I've been writing on my own for, I would say, about 5 or 6 years now. But it wasn't until last year did I really try to marry up my hobby, which is writing, to my interests, which is all things dissident right, and decided to start to try and contribute. And yeah, I've been doing that for about a year now. So that's about it.
That is fascinating. Now, I've been catching your articles whenever possible on Countercurrents. You need to step it up, though. I mean, we are wanting for content sometimes, and we are always wanting for quality content. And what can I say? We are putting our heads together over at Countercurrents. It is the University of the Dissident Right. And whether we like it or not, you and I, we are kind of professors. I never thought I'd be a professor. I thought I got rid of academia back when, but that's a story for another day. What can I say? It's our cross to bear, I guess. So let's get into it. Tonight is a best month ever type show. That means we will be reviewing what I consider to be a selection of interesting, thought-provoking, conversation-provoking articles which have been published on Countercurrents in the month of July. And let's start. What do we have here on the list? Oh, we have Anthony Bavaria. He has written a review of Arthur Nersesian's The Fuck Up. Now, that's a very interesting name, Nersesian. Nerses is, what kind of name is it? I think it's Parthian. Well, it could be.
I know, like, his full. I know his full last name, Nersesian. I think it's Armenian. And I looked up his wiki page after I had finished reading the book. And yeah, I think he's his father's Armenian, and his mother, I think she's Irish or something. But I think it's an Armenian last name.
That's very interesting. But there is a king named Narses, right? But I think he was a king of Persia, maybe. So why would an Armenian have a Persian name? Although, you know, there's quite a lot of overlap between two peoples, right?
Yeah.
So it's a story about the proto-hipster, you claim. Why don't you just give us put us into the short end of this article pool, if you will, Anthony?
Sure. So I'd actually been meaning to read the book for a really long time. I was in the tail end of college, and a guy I knew had more or less just flunked out, right? And it was kind of weird. So typically, I went away to college. So it was one of those schools, nobody was from the town. It was like a rural place. So if you flunked out or graduated or whatever, you went home or you moved on somewhere else. Nobody stayed there. There was nothing to do. This guy flunked out, and he's still there, right? It's like, what are you doing here, man? And we were all going out somewhere one night, and he was like killing time beforehand, and he was reading this book. And I looked over there. I said, what is this? You know, it's The Fuck Up. It's a great novel. And I kind of thought in the back of my head, I'm like, man, this kid's a fuck up. Like, that's kind of a coincidence. I didn't say anything, obviously. But I kind of stored it in the back of my head. I'm like, man, I should read that. That sounds interesting. I sat on it for like a decade. I totally forgot about it. And I don't know how it came across my purview about a year ago. Somebody mentioned it, or I read something about it online. I was like, oh, I forgot about that book. Picked it up, finally read it cover to cover. And it's an easy read. And it's also a great read. Nersessian's, I don't even know if that's how you pronounce it, but close enough for me. He is a great writer. He's I think from New York City, all his books take place there. And if you've ever spent any time in New York City, like you immediately get the vibe that like he knows his surroundings, he knows what he's talking about. And I've kind of written about it before a little bit, but I'm always fascinated when like a place is just as much as a character as a person, right? Like if a certain place can be, almost become a protagonist, like that fascinates me. So that's why I decided to do a review on it, shorthand, I guess.
That's actually very interesting. And getting into the your review, which thankfully does not reveal much of the work, too much to be enjoyed, I get the feeling that there is a yearning in the late Western civilization. This idea of the place being a character used to always be like that. Wherever you went, it's part of your life. It's a part of your life. The place you were from, the place you were born, is a character in the story of your life. And this is natural. This is to be expected. But over time, I guess, as we become more rootless and we live in more and more places, we lose connection to place, right? And I guess writers can no longer bring places to life because places aren't, they have never really been alive to begin with, right? It's in one of these interesting things. Now, my hometown of Skopje is full of memories for me. So whenever I walk any street of, well, at least my neighborhood, there's at least one memory there. And I hope I'm a good enough writer that I can bring that to life. That's interesting. You pointed it out there. It is the mark of a great writer that the setting itself interfaces with the character so perfectly. People have commented that this is what sets maybe Dostoevsky apart from the great Russian writers, because he can definitely put the setting in your head. You can imagine the sweltering heat of St. Petersburg in the summer when you're reading, for example, Crime and Punishment.
But do continue.
I think that the phenomenon, the cultural phenomenon of the hipster, is still not sufficiently understood, and we will be unpacking it in the years to come. But it's in your estimation that the fuck up is the novel which inspired the hipster lifestyle, and may have essentially elucidated a proto version thereof.
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, it's not like the causal factor, but it's one of many along the way to that, like you said, that specific hipster persona that I think really came into its own in the 2000s. The fuck up was definitely one of many inspirations for that, I think. And so much of it really does go back to place. I think you hit the nail on the head when you kind of referenced the rootlessness that a lot of people have today, moving around so much. Place becomes less and less important or meaningful to them. Also, depending on where you're from, in the first place. So like most white middle class or working class Americans, I'm from the suburbs, and the suburbs are kind of devoid of anything authentic, you know, just 5-lane commercial byways with strip malls and chain stores lining them endlessly. And behind that is just mazes of suburban tract housing. It's not really nice, right? And there are nice suburbs and there's also terrible ones. And they're really dull places to be from. So I think, like myself, growing up in the orbit of a major metropolitan city center, stuck out in the suburbs, a lot of kids yearned to move to the city, right? That's where the more authentic thing was happening. That's where it was cool. That's where it was fun. And, you know, gentrification of American city centers definitely started as early as the 80s and sped up in the 90s and really went into warp speed in the 2000s. And this story is set at the very early onset of that, where it's, you know, bored suburban types are clashing with like the decaying infrastructure and zombie people of the cities from the late 60s and into the 70s. And I think that yearning to be somewhere authentic coming from essentially nowhere is what kind of helps spawn that urban hipster culture that we're all so familiar with now.
It's interesting that you comment on the whole dialectic of suburban and urban life, because I mean, I look at pictures and videos and just speak with Americans who come from suburbs, and I keep thinking to myself, why in hell would anyone choose to live like that? I mean, I understand the yearning to live in a small town, right? I understand the desire to live away from the big city. As someone who's lived in a big city, right, my entire life, I wouldn't live in a small town, but I understand why people would live in a small town.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying here? I wouldn't live in the village, although I understand why people would want to live in a village. But for the life of me, I cannot see the appeal of a suburb. And it's not like a small town, because a small town still has a square, it has a main street, right? It has a place where people congregate. I guess the question I try to ask of people who live in suburbs, who move to suburbs, is where do the children play, right?
Well,
it's the whole thing with Cat Stevens, right? You got very fast cars, you got nice technology, but where do the children play? Where does the community go to congregate in a suburb? There is no square, there is no mainstream. Everyone commutes. You cannot walk anywhere. This is actually terrifying and disgusting to me as a European, that you cannot go in and out of the place by just walking. And who lives there? What's why?
I'm really glad to hear you ask all these questions, and more so use these specific terms. So like, what a lot of people don't realize is there is a difference between towns and suburbs, right? There's obviously a difference between the city and the countryside. But a lot of this stuff starts to blend together, and people get very confused by it. And I didn't realize it myself until I had went on vacation to Europe, when you see these, ancient city centers. And it was just amazing to me that you spend some time in any European city and then you travel elsewhere, and it almost seems like the city just stops and then the country begins, right? You know, there's like this demarcation of like, okay, I'm looking around and it's urbanized, and next thing you know, it's either woods or farm fields or countryside or what have you. And that was beautiful to me. And where I grew up, that did not exist, right? It's suburban sprawl, just almost endlessly. And to answer your question of who wants to live there, so as I've read about this over the years, I'm more and more under the impression originally the answer was no one, right? Like, these places were designed to put people in the same way public housing was, right? No one wants to live in, an impoverished high rise in the worst part of the city, right? Like, they're placed there. The suburbs were designed to kick out certain demographics of the urban centers. And this is where they were placed, right? A lot of World War II veterans got back from the war, came back to their ethnically homogeneous neighborhoods in Name Your American City. And they found out rather quickly, like, they're building a bridge here, or they're building a highway through my neighborhood, or they're demolishing our apartments and putting up public housing. And they were really trashing American cities with what they called at the time slum clearance, and building all these projects and stuff like that. And where did all these people need to go? Well, the federal government was incentivizing them to move out to these brand new private communities where everyone can have their own little plot of land and their own single family home. And they were more or less incentivized to move out there. No one ever really wanted to. They were enticed to, and it made it seem like it was a really good thing. But barely a generation or two later, their offspring couldn't wait to get out of there, right? Because just to your point exactly, like, where do the children play? I know where I played growing up, and it was all winter long. It was in other suburban homes, you know, my friends' families' basements, right? We just sat in basements and played video games. Like, that's kind of boring. And in the summertime, you just played in your little quarter-acre backyard plot, and that was it. There was nowhere to go. There was nothing to do.
That's actually tragic, because I think that the whole bifurcation of between jock and nerd is a phenomenon of suburban living. Because I'm a quote-unquote nerdy kid, right? I was always intellectually inclined.
Mm-hmm.
But I have, you know, played football, you know, foot football, not hand egg, European football, what you people call soccer.
Yeah.
On the street. I have kicked a ball through a window. I have thrown bricks at people. I was a bit of a naughty child, but like, I've never really thought of myself as a quote unquote nerdy kid.
Yeah.
Even though I'm very, very intellectual. In fact, you know, if you go by the stereotype checklist, I check almost every one of them, except the, I did wear glasses at one point. And I think that this whole malformation of people, and then there's also the whole thing about let the children play, so let's organize play dates, but that's not conducive to child development. I think that the point is that the children go out of the house and they meet other children, and this is how they form bonds, and this is how they form a relationship, and this is how they become very robust psychologically. I think I'm one of my fondest memories actually of childhood. We were, I think, four or five, the kids in our neighborhood group, right? Well, I was four or five. They were all older kids, they were younger kids. And this is, you know, downtown Skopje in the 90s, and there's a hairdresser salon across from my house. And a man came, I think it was maybe spring, summer. He was wearing a very heavy trench coat. Mm-hmm. And this was the 90s, so the women are getting the, whatchamacallem, the big curls, the big hair, right?
Yeah.
Right. So they're sitting under the big bell things, which are drying out their hair, and they're facing the street, and the guy just exposes himself through the window.
Jesus.
And I'm thinking, right, we that entire generation of children on that street, and we all saw him, right? The bean and the Franks, the beans and the Franks, right? We were supposed to be traumatized by that, but nobody was traumatized by that.
Yeah, you thought it was funny, right?
We thought it was hilarious because, you know, the ladies in there, they're of varying ages, right? They're screaming, they're shocked. It's like, but we're laughing our asses off. And I go home and I tell my mom, that guy, he showed his pee-pee to the ladies in the hairdresser salon.
Yeah. It's
really one of my fondest memories, ironically. But you think, you know, children who are developmentally not proper, maybe they do get traumatized by, you know, a man doing something like that.
But yeah, probably.
Because we were well socialized among each other, right? And, you know, people always talk about, oh, why would you want to homeschool your kids? They need socialization. I'm sorry. Socialization happens in the neighborhood. When your kid plays with other kids, you can have that without government schooling, without centralized schooling. And the street where we played, the traffic was low, again, 90s. So we played football right on the street. And I have very, very fond memories of my time as a youngster in the 90s. I think about where would you do that in an American-style suburb? It's just, if the street is peaceful enough, but I sincerely doubt it. And another thing, I want to talk about, you know, this liberals are always on about it on Twitter, right? Walkable cities.
Yeah.
You know? And to this point where I noticed that American conservatives are getting very, they're just getting allergic to the phrase and maybe embracing this whole idea that, well, cities don't need to be walkable because libtards want to have walkable cities. But you go to Europe, and very few cities are non-walkable. In fact, in Europe, I think if we had to live like Americans do, commuting to and fro just with cars all over the time, we would have riots. You know? So, and it's a big hipster talking point that you can actually just walk to everywhere you need to be. And that's a privilege of a homogenous society, I think.
Yeah, a lot of ways it is. And it's always frustrated me that like a lot of these topics become specifically liberal talking points, like you said, a walkable city or environmental issues. Like I don't know the history on how that like becomes exclusively a liberal thing. Like, do you mean to tell me that someone with like culturally conservative viewpoints doesn't enjoy going for a walk in their neighborhood to dinner and back? Or, you know, does a culturally conservative person like not give a shit about their own environment? You know, human influence, climate change aside, I'm just talking about, you know, being a good steward of your environment, right? Here in America, paleo conservatives were the ones that were the original environmentalists, right? You know, those were the guys that started the national park system. Those were the guys that started the Sierra Club. And all these guys were, you know, anti-immigration. I forget the guy that wrote the Monkey Wrench Gang. It's like the Bible for like eco-terrorists or self-described eco-terrorists today. But he lived in the American Southwest in the desert. And the reason he hated immigration, amongst many other reasons, was because mass migrations of people are typically bad for the environment. And if all you care about is your landscape and you want to preserve it and keep it a certain way, I don't care who's coming. I don't want them here. You know, they want to keep it a certain way. But yeah, nowadays, particularly in urban environments, like you said, walkable cities just becomes this like liberal talking point. And there's obviously no truth to that, right? Because it's something that everybody can enjoy. But conservative ink in America, mainstream conservatism, has just been in reaction to the left for so long that anything that the left professes to like, just default Republicans automatically take the opposite stance. Cities are terrible. Walking is terrible. It almost seems like they're just knee-jerk reacting to everything. And it's pretty pathetic because it's not true, you know?
It's very interesting to me that you can actually manipulate conservatives into saying bullshit like that, like walking is terrible.
Yeah. I don't know if anyone's actually said that line specifically, but yeah, they take these opposite stances on everything just give as a time. Knee-jerk reaction.
Just give it time. And the it begins with mocking liberals when they demand walkable cities, right? And this is something that's, you see it, I see it in the transformation of my own city of Skopje right here, that for a time there was a tendency, and it's still ongoing, of really making things difficult for people who do not own cars or do not like to drive. And for a very long time, I did not own a car or, you know, a driver's license. And at one point, the bank I used for business just closed the branch that was near to my office. Mm-hmm. And I asked the lady, when they said they're closing the branch, where can I do my business now? And she's like, oh, in that neighborhood, which is a long way away. And I'm like, how am I going to get there? She says, well, clients have been complaining that they can't park here, so we're moving over there. And I'm like, I don't have a car, lady. I don't have a driver's license, and I hate taking the bus.
Yeah.
And it's, what can I say? They're trying to force car culture on an urban core, which has been around since Roman times. So yeah. I demand walkable cities because why should I turn on a car every day? It's for trips out of town. Maybe, okay, if I'm hauling something across town, I get it. Okay. And another thing I noticed, that people buy food and then it goes bad. Why? Because they drive to the store. They drive to the mega store, right? And they get everything. whereas I just walk over to the farmer's market, which is very close to my house, and buy the thing I need for the day. This is why I always eat fresh food, and that's why I am so handsome, among other things. So, of course, hipsters don't usually call themselves hipster, but I embrace that label. You know, I think you know it when you see it.
Yeah, and the frustrating thing about the, you know, quote unquote walkable city nowadays is, and I know a lot of people hate this term, but there is a lot of merit to it. You know, the Globo Homo Urban Center, like they're increasingly all the same, right? You know, it's the same panini shop that you can get anywhere, the same coffee places, all with the, you know, name your flags hanging in the windows, supporting whatever current thing cause. Like it's sad that they've all homogenized in this way. So, you know, there is some merit to it being, you know, somewhat of a liberal thing, because that's the overarching, you know, culture in these places, but it doesn't need to be, right? Like, does a hardware store need to have a certain set of flags hanging in the window? No, it should just be a hardware store, right?
My local hardware store does not have flags hanging in the window. It just doesn't.
Nor should they.
Right. They sell tools. They sell, you know, hardware. They sell stuff people need to do manly stuff, I guess, or womenly. They also sell mops and brooms. So, you know, there's always that. I mean, there's something for everyone at the hardware store. Unfortunately, I cannot give their name because they have yet to sponsor the writer's block. Yeah, yes, I'll bummer. Learn it right there. Anyways. So you would recommend that people actually get and read The Fuck Up by Arthur Narcissian.
Definitely. Nothing even remotely dissident about it. I don't even really know the guy's viewpoints, but it's a great, fun novel. And, you know, gentrification is really just the backstory behind it, or it's just like a background thing. You know, most of the protagonist's storyline just kind of goes through a series of fuck-ups, just like the title describes. And it's a fun read. It's funny. And for anyone that spent any time in New York City or any urban center similar to it, I think they'll enjoy it.
What's interesting to me is this concept of the guy who keeps fucking up, right? And you tie this very nicely to a lot of people who are in our movement, and let's not beat around the bush, people. Bush here, there is a lot of fuck ups in this movement, myself, I would say, included, right? People who have failed in one way or another at other aspects of life, and yet we are here doing whatever. And I guess our very presence here is a form of fuck up. You didn't know better than to keep your mouth shut about the race stuff, and now you're here. You didn't know you just couldn't keep yourself from touching all the nasty racist Nazi stuff, and now you're here in this ball pit with these horrible people, with these horrible Nazis, right? I guess there is something to be learned from this book, because it is, in essence, about people who are similar to us, people who fuck up, right?
I mean, for better or worse, yeah, there is a lot of truth to that, you know. I don't even have the review pulled up right now. Let's see if I can pull it up super quick. But yeah, I can't remember the line that he had there at the end that like made me think of, you know, like you said, people in our movement. There was a couple things. I got it right here. Yeah, so he just said, like, people being under or unemployed, unconnected, and unmotivated, and, you know, reaching this self-reflective starkness, right? There's a lot of things and realities that people in our movement that are attuned to that will just absolutely suck the life out of you, right? And I kind of mentioned in the article, you know, you'll feel this way as you watch your civilization dismantled around you. It's really blackpilling, right? And I think, you know, for better or worse, it drives people to our movement. I guess it's a good thing, because, you know, we're speaking in bland realities here, and more people need to hear that. But I guess it stinks on how a lot of people do wind up here. Just basically modern society rejecting them.
There is this whole thing about, just because society rejects you does not mean you're not a quality person, that you are a quote unquote fuck up. There is such a thing as being rejected by a profoundly sick society, and ours is a profoundly sick society. You will find yourself rejected more often than not because you're a white man. That would absolutely be the first thing, right? Secondly, a lot of people find themselves rejected because they're honest, because they cannot lie, or they will not lie, or because they have found lies that are just too big, right? A lot of people can do small lies, but big lies, gross distortions of the truth, such as, I don't know, all men are created equal, and actually saying and meaning and believing that, that's a bridge too far for, I would say, most people. And so they're chewed out and spat out by modern society. And we're getting at a time where even a minor departure from orthodoxy gets you cast out. You know, it's no longer one of these days where basically Pat Buchanan can keep his column and still be a little racist and anti-Semitic, even though, you know, how anti-Semitic was Pat Buchanan realistically? Not much, really, right? But he could still keep his various columns at various publications, be a public intellectual, run for president, even though he didn't really make much of it. And no, now the time is we are looking at complete ideological conformity. Even minor deviations from the party line are going to get you sacked.
Absolutely.
Right. So a lot of high quality people are getting rejected by the modern world. This has been going on for a long time. People have commented that the left has gotten significantly crazier since 2012-11, right? And this is about the time when they started ejecting white, heterosexual white men from the left. There was no more ground to stand on for white, heterosexual men on the left. Even nowadays, you get the dirtbag leftists, but they're basically outcasts.
Yeah.
They're not in the garden of earthly pleasures, no longer accepted by the leftist cult. There just is no way for you to be a straight white guy and be on the left right now. And this has come really with a decrease of discourse on the left, because all the other races, they're just bad at doing things. What can I say?
Well, that's why I take solace in reading and writing on a place like Countercurrents. You know, Jesus spoke of his willingness to be counted amongst the wicked. And if I'm going to be a wicked person for thinking, reading, and writing bland truths, all right, fine. I guess I'm wicked.
Yes, we shall inhabit the role of the villain, and they're going to regret they cast us in it. What can I say? We can only hope that one day our good names will be cleared, though a prophet is never so disrespected as is in his hometown. And let's see what the masses have to say. Are there any questions? Are there any donations? We do have 14 lemons from Slog. And every show, like clockwork, our Finnish brother Slog donates the 14 lemons. And that number 14, what a number. It looks to me like it's part of some conceptual whole. Now, you know, I got a memory like a sieve, so if anyone could just remind me of the other half of that conceptual whole with a donation, preferably, in the amount, and that would be nice. We have now a question on entropy. It's for 14 American dollars. Again, that number, 14. You people are just going hog wild on my obsessive compulsive disorder. From the red line, 14 American dollars, and he says, a positive trade to the hipster culture, which ties into the lack of culture of the suburbs, is that the hipsters are very keen on everything original, from old jukeboxes to original doorknobs, which shows a longing for authenticity and a place to belong to. Now, how would you respond to that, Anthony? Do you agree with that.
Yeah, I do. Like there is a lot of truth to that. You know, growing up in a very bland environment, like, you know, if you have a mind that is naturally drawn towards something real and something more authentic, you know, only good can come of that. You know, better food, you know, better interests and things like that. And unfortunately, time after time, it's just steered into vapid materialism, vice, authenticity in, you know, an ontological sense or a metaphysical sense. It's always just very skin deep, surface veneer type stuff, type authenticity. And honestly, I think that's a pretty good segue into one of the articles we're going to discuss. I don't even know how to pronounce it. I Dream of Jeannie. Is that the two-part thing on Orientalism? Who wrote it? Yep. Was it Catherine S.? Is that right? Yeah,
Catherine S. I mean, Dream of Jeannie, right?
Jeannie, there you go. That read was eye-opening to me. And it just hits the nail on the head of, you know, the modern day hipster just getting into like skin deep, quote unquote, authentic cultures from anywhere else but their own. Right. And her article there, you know, honed in on, you know, the Oriental aspect of it. But I mean, go to, you know, name your Globo Homo walkable city center like we talked about. Right. And like how many dudes do you see, you know, in the yoga outfits and everything. And like, is there any white man living in Brooklyn that gets into boxing, or are they all just doing yoga? Right. Like just the least, the, you know, the least European thing they can think of, like that's what they default to essentially.
Well, you know, the traditionalist crowd would disagree with you about yoga. And I just saw this, this afternoon I saw Marcus Fullan, the golden one, actually doing yoga. He uploaded a video on Telegram of himself doing yoga. And I've had it recommended to me by my orthopedist for my back. I've had it recommended to me by bodybuilders and martial artists. So there is something to it. But I will say, yeah, there is an element of Orientalism about yoga. And as someone who's actually done martial arts, I will say the Western ones are the best. They are the most effective at getting things done, you know, kicking people's asses, which is the goal of martial arts, of self-defense, let's put it more diplomatically there. Well, yeah, I think Catherine really just hones in not just on Orientalism as such, but at the desire to appropriate the foreign, which I believe lies at the heart of Western Europeans, and specifically Northwestern European civilization, has always had this deep, dark emptiness within its belly, this civilizational insecurity, you could say it, about itself. Maybe it's something about really growing up in the shadow of Rome that you really don't think of yourself as great or grand. So you always go out into the world and seek out something greater than yourself and attempt to appropriate it and thereby become great. We see it even in as far back as the Romans, just going out into Egypt, dragging back obelisks and Roman women decking themselves out in Eastern styles, as they called them, really dressing up like Egyptian women, like Persian women, dressing up in silks, trying to emulate the Chinese. It's something of a civilizational disease with us Europeans that we go out, seek the foreign, and try to appropriate it. Have you noticed anything like that? I mean, it's not even just the East. One of the things I've written, which I'm most proud of, and it's, I think I wrote it in June, I don't remember though, is really about White Boy Summer, and it touches upon tiki culture, upon which James O'Meara has written, that it's essentially the culture of Americans who conquered the Pacific and are now appropriating this culture of Polynesia, right, for their own amusement and enjoyment. Have you noticed this trend, Anthony?
Absolutely. And I really like your points about, it being uniquely European and going back way into our history. You mentioned Roman women dressing Egyptian. I can't remember for the life of me where I read it, but in late stage Rome, I remember reading it was fashionable for young men to parade around the forum dressed like, like a Germanic warrior. You know, they'd be wearing like wolf shawls over their shoulders and leather pants and like to look like a Hun, you know, became a vogue thing. And you can see it today for sure. It's still happening. And I really do go back and forth on like how much is too much. So for example, when you think of firearms, who do you automatically default to? Who's the first group of people you think to? You know, a lot of people think of Westerners, right? Americans with guns and Europeans in essentially inventing guns and, you know, proliferating them all over the world. But I mean, gunpowder came from the East, right? So it's like, yes, we did discover this thing from somewhere else, but we made it into something of our own. There's always going to be cross-cultural pollination. If you ever go surfing, and you look at who's surfing out there in the lineup, it's all white dudes, right? But, you know, surfing comes from Polynesia. So like, you know, they've taken something foreign and made it into their own, which I think is fine. But yeah, it's when you, kind of cross that bridge, and you just immediately go native, and you don't come back. It's kind of weird. And I guess I am constantly wondering, you know, what is too much of that? You mentioned,
I guess when you have no center, right?
Yes.
You can get sucked in by the thing, right? Cause I've done a lot of non-European things in my life. I've done Wing Chun, which is Chinese, Krav Maga, which is Israeli, right? But I always had my center, and it was always in the service of my center. I've even done yoga, but don't tell anyone. Oh, guess. I just said it on stream. I admitted it. Okay. My manhood will never recover.
Well, listen, a guy like the Golden One, he's in a lot better shape than me. So if he's doing yoga, yeah, sure. Okay. I'll listen to it. You know,
it's actually very helpful. I've been struggling with carpal tunnel syndrome recently.
You don't make it your identity though, right? I said, you don't make it your sole identity. You said you always have your center still. So I think that's a really good point.
That is really the key. I mean, I've written before on the subject of really appropriating, just straight up cultural appropriation, right? You appropriate cultural artifacts and aspects from the entire world, and you forge high culture out of it. Really. Mm-hmm. And it came to me when I was enjoying Japanese culture. I was eating taiyaki, and these are fish-shaped waffles, and they're filled with azuki bean paste, right? And it's really something that only the Japanese could have come up with.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
And although waffles are European, again, it is itself a syncretic dish, because they take this European dish, which is the waffle, but they put a Japanese twist on it. They have it in the shape of a fish, and they fill it with a plant, the paste of a plant native to Japan, right? But then mm-hmm. they serve it with ice cream, which is, again, this time an Italian thing, whereas waffles are Belgian. And that's another thing. You notice that the Japanese are great lovers of syncretic art. They are great xenophiles, and have been since before Commodore Perry. And it came to me that the way to forge high culture is really to go out into the world, find what's good and fun and useful and interesting and inspiring, bring it back home and integrate it within your center, right? Now, you don't have to get the people. I was eating the taiyaki fish, but the guy who made it to me was Lily White. He had been to Japan. He had learned from the Japanese, but there were no Japanese people preparing the taiyaki for me. So this whole thing, oh, we need immigration for the recipes. No, you can import the recipe without the people. It's information.
It also without through the internet. Destroying your home culture as well, right?
Right. So, and you know, there was a joke, Lord Miles Rutledge, He's this British travel guy. He was in Macedonia recently and commented that we had the best Mexican food he's ever had. But there are no Mexicans in Macedonia.
No.
So it's just one of those things, I guess.
Yeah, I think in Catherine's article, she kind of like tipped her hat to, you know, where a lot of this really comes from, particularly the skin deep interest in foreign objects. She mentions with the tulips, with the Dutch, and it was the Dutch merchant class, the proto-globalism types that were the ones importing these foreign cultures. And I mean, what were they doing it for, right? Like they were doing it to make money. And I think back to like, okay, so they were making tons of money and the cosmopolitan Dutch were freaking out over these imports and, you know, paying top dollar for all of it. But what was the working class Dutchman out in a farm field doing? Like he was probably just like, what is this crap? I don't care. You know, I think back to my grandmother. She's your typical Italian American type. You know, she's in her 90s and she's never once had Chinese food. Not because she thinks it's going to taste bad, but she's in her eyes, why would she? She's not, you know, like, and I've almost respected, you know, her ardent refusal to even go down that road. She's just like, no, I eat my American food and I eat my Italian food and that's me and that's it. You know, she's almost impervious to, you know, any type of globalist type trying to push anything on her for a profit. She's like, these aren't the two things that I eat. Screw off. And I can't help but respect that a little bit.
No, your grandma could just be anti-Semitic.
Maybe, I don't know.
I mean, I always found that association between Chinese food and Jews. It's interesting, but they do eat Chinese food on Christmas, I think. That's in Seinfeld, so it's got to be true.
Yeah, of course, right? It's a fact.
I mean, the common folk, they really don't need high culture, so they will, I mean, there will be some Orientalism among them as well, because everyone wants to feel high class every now and then, and especially in a culture which makes a fetish out of upward mobility such as ours. Yeah, even working class guys will look to the East or maybe the God forbid, the global South, you know, and emulate these foreign cultures. I mean, Orientalism, it can look like the Dutch buying tulips or Mozart calling his latest composition the Rondo alla Turca, you know, the Turkish march. Or it can really look like guys trying to be ninjas and samurais and watching anime, or God forbid, becoming wiggers and rappers.
Yeah.
White guys trying to be black, although that I have noticed that is a middle class phenomenon.
Absolutely.
Poor white guys, working class white guys, when they are dysfunctional, they do not look like wiggers, right? They have a very different approach to dysfunction and poverty. But I guess that's the story for another day. And it is very interesting. So any other takeaways from Catherine's article? I find that whenever I read a Catherine S. article, I'm just drawn into this world she weaves for us. She's easily one of my favorite writers on countercurrents. I'm just giving away my absolute fanboyism here.
Oh, you and me both. I learned so much from that. She just referenced the Ottomans taking Constantinople, turning it into essentially one giant garden. I had no clue about that. The opulent French uniforms that they took from North Africa and, you know, wearing those for decades to come. I mean, to the point where, like, there were Union Civil War soldiers wearing those. I had no idea about any of that. But it kind of reminded me of some of the, the modern American soldiers you see in photographs from the global war on terror over the past 20, 25 years now, wearing the shemags and stuff like that. You know, they're in their U.S. Army tactical uniforms and all their gear, and they got the shemag wrapped around their neck. Obviously, that's for a practical reason, the same reason that
the keffiyeh thing, the black and white shawl.
Yes, Yeah, the thing that goes around their like neck and head. You know, they're wearing it to keep sand, you know, off right. their face when the sand blows in the desert. It's something they adopted, but it quickly turns into, I think, a sort of status piece. You know, look at me, I'm hardcore, I'm out there in the field, I need to wear this kind of thing. And, you know, I don't think it's ever going
to... It's interesting. We were talking about hipsters. It used to be the hipster uniform. And I think it originates from just libtardism, just, solidarity with Palestinians, right? Well, yeah. You have this other almost polar opposite group of people, American soldiers who tend to be, you know, rural, white, not exactly shitlibs or hipsters, and they're wearing it because of A, practical considerations, and B, to show off their status as warriors.
Yes. It's kind of weird. I guess they have more in common than they'd like to think. I don't know.
Yeah, it is interesting because I have written criticizing Red America that it just will not appropriate foreign cultures. How much of Iraq and Afghanistan has really poured out into the American heartland? By contrast, I mean, the British completely plundered India. I mean, culturally speaking, not only just stealing cultural artifacts. I don't think they even took back artifacts, but culturally speaking, so much of India poured into the culture of the English upper and middle classes, and you know, then was transferred to the American English upper and middle classes. We were talking about yoga, and the beginnings of yoga in the West are really English, not even aristocrats, but the Anglo-Indians, right, from the Raj, bringing it back and integrating it into Western esotericism. The first place where you can read about yoga in the West is, I think, maybe not Aleister Crowley, maybe it was someone that Aleister Crowley ran, but the contact of the British and Indian civilizations left them both changed forever. You know, and people comment on just how British India still is, you know, in its organizational form, but I think we underestimate just how Indian that encounter left Britain, even if we left aside the Indians moving to Britain.
Oh, absolutely. Just from a cultural sense. I mean, even the, even just in fashion, isn't, you know, the cummerbund and the tuxedo, I think that came from India. Like it's informal dress. It's absolutely everywhere. And like you said, that's without the mass population migrations. I really wonder what, you know, Heartland America, what the, you know, wars in the Middle East and their cultural impact will have in 10, 20, 30 years. And like you said, just aside from all of them moving here, just from a cultural sense.
Yeah. I don't think you can spend time among a people, even as a soldier of a foreign army, and not absorb something from them. I know a guy who went to Afghanistan, and I think one of the first things he said to me when he came back was, I didn't know what Islam was. Because, you know, we grew up around Albanians and Turks here in Macedonia, and they're either secular or they're practicing a form of Islam that really you cannot really respect, even as a foreign religion. But this guy was thoroughly impressed by people who genuinely believed. You know, he had nothing good to say about Islam before going to Afghanistan. But when he came back after Muslims shot at him, he had respect for the religion. It was very interesting. I should check up on him, see how he has developed. But maybe we will not see the manifestations of these influences for a long time. Although it is a shame, I would have loved to see American Mesopotamian and American Bactrian syncretism, because yeah. I am a respecter of all three of those cultures. It's Bactrian culture itself, you know, of Afghanistan, it is syncretic. It is syncretic of the tribe of the people who are native there and the Greco-Bactrian kingdom, which is a successor to Alexander's empire. Again, these things happen. And while we're on the subject, Alexander, who he is the king of all Orientalists. He is maybe one of the first Orientalists of the West some will say to his detriment, but wow, what a guy, what a guy. I guess the only person who really took the whole let's go out and syncretize our cultures things seriously was Bo Bergdahl. You remember Bo Bergdahl?
Oh yeah. Was he the guy that got captured?
Yeah, well, he got captured, but apparently he sought out the Taliban so he could learn from them, apparently.
That's right. Yeah. It's kind of a bigger point to, you know, what Catherine mentioned in her article, like the foreign stuff overriding, you know, your own domestic culture. You know, how many British people or Americans or whoever who are just so devoid of their own culture, it's just been taken away from them systematically for decades now. You know, you have white teenage idiots going to join ISIS and things like that. They just see something authentic, like your buddy that fought in Afghanistan. And they can't help but gravitate toward it in one degree or another because what they have at home is just so lacking. And that's not their own fault. It's been taken away from us for decades now.
I guess that's why so many guys become hipsters, right? There is nothing for you to anchor yourself to. So you're just going to be this free floating thing, absorbing whatever from the ether and just do living your life ironically, I guess. Whereas you're exposed to something as fundamentally and indubitably real as conflict in, let's say, Afghanistan, that changes you profoundly. And there's just no going back from that.
That's no, something I cannot imagine.
Think about. Yeah. Well, unless you have something more to say and more to add on Catherine's work, I think it's time to move on.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay. So let's see here. We have donations. We have Bartleby donating an ice cream. And thank you for that, Bartleby. And thank you for keeping at it. For moderating the chat tonight. And let's move on to, since we were discussing conflict and war, Top Goy, Maverick,
oh, yes.
Thomas Steuben. Well, apparently, they're bringing back Tom Cruise and Top Gun. And I got to say something. I have not seen the original Top Gun.
Oh, you got to see it.
Do I? Do I really have to? Is there a gun pointed to my head? Because I don't think I'm going to see it unless there is. I mean, I might even take my chances with the bullet.
It's worth it's worth it in the most turn your brain off and just enjoy something for an hour and a half sense.
I don't think I'd maybe able to do it. I just find Tom Cruise's face very annoying. is he in the movie much?
Oh yeah, I mean it's all him.
okay, so yeah, I might actually have a coronary, I might throw my laptop out the window. Who knows? I really don't like Tom Cruise. There's something about the cut of his jib that turns me off. I have not even seen the Mission Impossibles, but I am aware of the cultural phenomenon, which is Top Gun. It's really nice where you don't have to see a film and more or less understand what it is about, just through pop cultural osmosis. And apparently they made a sequel. They made a sequel, and he's still flying aeroplanes. And it's not going to recruit as many people into the U.S. Navy, apparently, as the original is, but it is going to make a lot of money for the producers.
I was thinking about that, yeah. When the original one came out in the mid-80s, apparently it caused this huge spike in recruitment. Young dudes watched the movie, thought it was amazing, and immediately want to go do it themselves and sign up. Is that going to happen today in 2022? My gut feeling is no. It hasn't yet, I don't think, and I don't think it will either. People are just so removed from that way of life now. 20 years of the global war on terror, I think, has put a bad taste in a lot of people's mouth, rightfully so. I don't think you're going to get that. I wrote an article for Man's World. It's like an online magazine I don't know if you're familiar with. But I wrote an article about, Hollywood messaging backfiring, and that's happened a lot, over the, you know, the past, decades of movie making. Top Gun actually glorified conflict, right? And then people took the cue and went and joined. But every now and then there's an anti-war movie like Full Metal Jacket. He tries to, shit on conflict. And I agree, conflict isn't good, but it still has the adverse effect. It caused a spike in recruitment in the Marine Corps. And I can't help but chuckle when things like that happen sometimes.
Well, I think the top Full Metal Jacket isn't so much anti-conflict, but it's against conflict when it's poorly fought. Because if you really, there is like a charitable viewing of Full Metal Jacket that's an indictment on American command during Vietnam and just how shambolic command is. Because if you look at the Vietnam sections of the whole thing, you realize that unfortunately common though this may be in Western military history, it's a situation of guys who are all they can be, they are doing their duty, they are going above and beyond, but they are being commanded by complete and utter morons. Like that general who says, like, in every gook there's an American struggling to get out.
Yeah.
Right. If you believe that as a commander of American troops in Vietnam, you're going to do some very stupid things. And you're going to waste a lot of young lives, which could otherwise have been used for good, right? Even in just the military sense, you could have used those men better, and some would have died because that's war. But if you believe wrong things about the world, these things have consequences, especially in the military, right? And I guess, nevertheless, because the guys who are actually fighting the war in that film, they're portrayed as conducting themselves with honor and doing their duty and actually not feeling too bad about it. They're so happy they're singing the Mickey Mouse March at the end, right?
Yeah.
And I guess there's always the hope that you can make boom boom with the Vietnamese hooker in the end. That's surprisingly appealing to a group of people. We will not talk about them tonight, though. I'm speaking on a full belly here. Explain the spike of recruitment after Full Metal Jacket. I guess if you're not portraying the soldiers themselves as stupid or anything, if you treat soldiers with respect in a movie, you're going to see an increase in recruitment. You might even get more increase in recruitment in a story, with a story which criticizes the government and the flag officers, but treats soldiers with respect, because you know it's not bullshitting you, right? It's sincere. It's sincere if it tries to pose itself with... If the movie poses like an anti-war movie, but still glorifies soldiers without maybe even glorifying conflict, that's actually pretty clever. That's if it's intentional. I don't know if it's intentional, but if it is, it's very clever.
Also, the time in which these came out. So, first Top Gun came out in the 80s. I believe Full Metal Jacket came out in the 80s as well. There was still a lot of tough guys around back then that saw that, thought it was tough and manly, and wanted to go do it themselves. Like, is there a giant pool of tough do-it-yourself Americans in 2022? Are they going to watch Top Gun and immediately want to go do it? Yeah, sure, there's plenty, but I would default assume substantially less that want to go down that road.
Indeed. Indeed, I mean... The fundamental problem is, I guess, yeah, people do not want to fight for the government, but are there even men worth fighting, fight-worthy men, right?
Yeah, men, I mean, I'm sure there still are, but substantially less. And I kind of thought about it when I was reading the Top Goy review. It's just such a funny title. But the author kind of referenced, some of the multiculturalism in the movie. And that got me thinking of the type of people that do join the military. So I know it showed the younger cadre of pilots And I mean, they were all very obviously diversity hires. It was a perfect spread of black, white, brown, male, female, and everything. But from what I understand, though the American military is very diverse, the more elite a unit gets, or the more combat oriented a unit gets, basically the more white it is, right? So, you know, whites comprise, I don't know what the number is anymore, 60 to 70% of America. But I think Air Force fighter pilots are almost all to a man white, right? The people that run the administration department, that's a perfect spread of diversity. But the guys actually doing the fighting, all the fighter pilots. I know this movie was Navy, not Air Force, but that's an assumption. I don't have data on it, but I think there's been some stuff written about that. I would wonder how, I have no idea, but with how many Indians and Pakistanis are in the United Kingdom, how many of them are in the Royal Military? I have no idea. Is it still an overwhelmingly large amount of white Englishmen that are doing the fighting?
It's, I mean, you notice something like, if you look at the demographics of a country's military, you notice that it's not, for example, a country which is multiracial, like America, it's not just that the combat arms are white, they're specifically Appalachian, right? They're
red. I know in the U.S. Army, that's overwhelmingly true. The Army heavily recruits from the South. The Army is very diverse and multicultural. But when you get into the infantry, it's more white. And then when you get into the Army Rangers, it's way more white. And then Green Berets and all those guys, I think it's their majority white. And like you said, a lot of Appalachian Southern types are in those ranks top down.
Exactly. And it's specifically, and you look at, this is not just true in America, this is true in European armies. So for example, the French army is almost 100% white, even though, I mean, France is, I think, 90, maybe 89% white at this point. So that's still a lot, but the army is 100% white French guys and vastly disproportionately Bretons, like, so guys from Bretagne. I think really? They're like 60% of the French army. I could be wrong, though. And wow. So this is like Celtic France, deep Celtic France, the peninsula south of Normandy, just across the channel from the United Kingdom. You look at the British Army; it's disproportionately Scottish and Northern, right? So Northern English, not so much from the home counties. You look at you look at the Spanish Army; disproportionately Galician again. So you see this in a lot of armed forces, that the guys who are soldiering, and especially in the combat arms, they will be disproportionately from one region of the country, right? I don't know the data about the Italian army. I should look into it, but I wouldn't be surprised that every European army, maybe even every army in the world, represents this trend. So it's not just disproportionately white, it's disproportionately Appalachian in America. A Southern too, you know, Texan, but specifically the Scotch Irish. And if you look at the history of America, this is the most warlike group of white people which moved to America. So obviously,
the frustrating thing is, for a long time now, those primary warrior class demographics that you're referencing are not the ones calling the shots on the conflicts they are fighting in, right? And it kind of reminded me of, first of all, Steuben's review, it's obviously a fictional movie, but he references it in his review. He says the reason they're invading this unnamed country, which is obviously Iran, is to restore security for their quote unquote allies in the region. Right. So it's not the Scots-Irish soldier, you know, picking where the fight's going to happen. It's someone else doing it. And he's hoodwinked into thinking it's for his freedom or something like that. It honestly kind of reminded me of the other article you sent me, the Carl's Decker war piece, or Deckels. I don't know how to say that. I felt so bad for that guy watching that little review of him like crying, saying it's not the country he fought for. But, you know, throughout time, men have always been hoodwinked into fighting in wars. And to me, that guy Deckel, he did not seem, you know, all too dissimilar from, you know, the average Appalachian white American fighting in the Middle East and thinking it was for a good cause. You know, like these guys were all to one degree or another sold a bill of false, you know, a bill of false goods on some of the reasons for these conflicts.
Indeed. And yeah, maybe this is a good segue into Spencer J. Quinn's Carl Deckel's War, which is basically a treatment, his response to an interview with an old man, 100-year-old Marine veteran, who just breaks down into tears when he describes just how alienated he is from modern America. And what I found interesting about the whole thing is people were saying in the comments that even though the guy is very obviously heartbroken, you can tell he's not heartbroken for himself. You know, there is, he speaks about his sacrifice, the sacrifices he's made, but he also says, nobody will have my opportunity, nobody will have my happiness anymore. In a sense, Carl Deckel, he's weeping for us, for the younger men who come after him, you know, younger Americans who came after him, who are just not going to have a country to grow old in. And that's where, you know, he got to me.
Absolutely.
Because this is a guy, he's not just one of those where my country gone people. Those are a dime a dozen, although they are right. Indeed, where my country gone is a valid question. But this guy is not, it's not about him and it's not about his country. It's about the country he wanted to bequeath to the youth. But then now there's nothing left to bequeath, and so he weeps for the youth. That's my take on it. And it's just an emotional, powerful piece. It packs a wallop. There will be no dry eyes in the room, I tell you that.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that hits the nail on the head. And I mean, this is true throughout history. So, you know, though change is always inevitable, it certainly seems to have been speeding up, you know, more in, you know, since Mr. Deckel's time to ours now, right? And I kind of thought about, like, if you took a time machine and went back to medieval Europe and you just, you know, plucked a European farmer from his land and transported him 200 years into the future and put him back in his own village, there was a good chance everything was going to look essentially the same. I mean, okay, maybe it sucked if like the Khan rolled through and like burnt his whole village down. But like outside of that happening, you know, technology wise, culturally, everything was going to kind of be the exact same. Nowadays, you know, forget about 200 years. In 20 years, the entire landscape, everything has completely changed. So you look at a guy like this sergeant from the Marine Corps in World War II. I mean, he's essentially living in a foreign land now, in a technological sense, in a cultural sense, in a demographic sense, in every sense of the way, everything has changed. And that sucks for a guy that fought for a place that doesn't exist anymore. Obviously, the conflict he fought in is to this day hotly debated in our circles. To me, it almost seems that he fought in a different war. The Pacific War and the European War they are vastly different in a million different ways. But I mean, you can almost entirely separate them. Like, he was a Marine. To my knowledge, I don't think a single Marine, U.S. Marine, fought in the European theater. I think they were completely in the Pacific, and the causes for that were entirely different than, you know, what happened in Europe.
It's certainly Yaki's opinion that the conflict between America and Germany in Europe is a fundamentally very different conflict from the conflict between America and Japan in the Pacific Ocean. That essentially, when America was destroying Japan, it was beating back the outer revolt against European dominion over the world. whereas America's war against Germany was a part of the Outer Revolt's efforts to destroy Europe. Francis Parker Yockeys, that's his position, which I take from The Enemy of Europe, published by Countercurrents. So
I have it, and now that you mention it, that's probably where I got the idea. I've just internalized it, thought of it as my own already.
Well, you can always tell that it doesn't take a genius. Yockey was a genius indeed, but it does not take a genius to see that there was a fundamental difference between the European and the Pacific War. I mean, for all the piss and vinegar about samurai valor, we should underline that Germany fought literally to the last man, whereas the Japanese surrendered without a single American foot stepping on Honshu, right, the main Japanese island. In fact, of the Japanese islands, all four, not one of them had a single American on them when the capitulation was signed, right? Yeah. I mean, Okinawa was captured. The writing was on the wall, but the writing was on the wall even earlier with the Germans, and the Germans just did not surrender. So that tells you really about the qualitative difference in warrior spirit between the white and yellow races. And I called upon this in my China piece, which is controversial. People do not, I mean, you think on a quote unquote racist website, people would not be that miffed when someone says we should not let Asians run the world. But, you know, you live, you learn.
Yeah.
It is. You are right that his war was primarily a white on yellow race war, right? It was a war in which America was wresting control of the Pacific away from the Empire of Japan as a rival, anti-colonial, non-white power. The Japanese are pretty tame and docile today. We forget that they were a serious threat to white hegemony in East Asia, and just like the Chinese are today.
Absolutely.
And this was actually something people tend to forget. There were Japanese plans to invade and occupy Australia and New Zealand and subjugate their white populations and do unspeakable things to them, as previews of which were seen in the prisoner of war camps by the Japanese.
That's very true. That being said, though, I think that the Japanese and Germans were similar in the sense that, like, their overestimations of their capability are just almost obnoxious. I think when the Japanese invaded mainland China, the army generals, like, dismissively quipped, like, oh, it'll be a 3 or 4 month campaign. We'll just brush these people aside. And they were just mired in the swamp of mainland China for years and years and years. I mean, even the German invasion of the East, they had captured as many Soviets as they thought existed in the military. You know, their German intel was assessing Soviet numbers, infantry numbers of 3 to 4 million. They had captured that many before they'd even got to the gates of Moscow. I mean, just gross over exaggerations. And Japan in particular was a massive paper tiger. And as soon as we pushed back, they stumbled, and it was a 3 year long stumble all the way back to their home islands, and which you just referenced culminated in ultimate surrender. You also mentioned Buchanan earlier. I have his book on my shelf, Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. I haven't gotten to it yet. I've been wanting to read it for a really long time, but he kind of talks about a diplomatic way out of the war, and also further alludes to differences that we're talking about between the war in Japan and the war in Germany. The war in Europe absolutely seemed as if there was a diplomatic way out of it, and there were a lot of actors ruthlessly working day and night to make that conflict happen. Whereas in the Pacific, the Japanese kind of seem to do it on their own accord.
There is, of course, I would say the war in Europe between Germany and the Soviet Union, there was no avoiding that. especially if you subscribe to the view, which I do tentatively, that the German campaign against the Soviet Union was in fact a preemptive strike, preempting a Soviet invasion, a renewed Soviet invasion of Europe. So we are talking, of course, in 1941. It's barely 14 years after the not 14 years, but it's barely 20 years after the Soviet-Polish War, in which the Soviet Union attacked Poland, the newly resurrected Poland, and the Baltic states, and was defeated in what was called by the Polish the Miracle on the Wisla, right? Where basically for every Polish soldier, there were seven Soviets, and the Polish somehow managed to win, right? Somehow managed to defeat the Red Army under Trotsky. So this memory is still very fresh in Europe that the Soviets are invading. And of course, there was the partition of Poland between Germany and the Soviet Union. And Stalin is, of course, hoping that Hitler would waste himself attacking the French, the Danish, the Norwegians, and English, and he can just roll over Europe. But Operation Barbarossa, people have pointed out that it is very haphazardly planned, that Germans were dispatched with substandard equipment, precisely because there was no time to organize something better, because the Soviet attack was imminent. And precisely this aggressive stance of the Soviet Union was what allowed the Germans to penetrate so deeply into Soviet territory so fast, so rapidly, really. But yeah, the war in Europe, I don't think that the Soviet-German theater would have been avoided. Although it was entirely possible to avoid the German-Polish War, the German-English and German-French wars. Specifically, we know that Poland would have preferred to ally with Poland. Hitler would have preferred to ally with Poland rather than go to war with it, because Poland was a great army. It obviously managed to defeat the Soviets before. However, it appears that the Polish government, which was inherited from Marshal Pilsudski by unworthy people, was manipulated into essentially making itself into an enemy of Germany. And, I mean, I'm not letting the Poles off the hook here. They allowed themselves to be manipulated by primarily British intelligence. But, yeah, it would have been very different if Germany and Poland had allied against the Soviet Union and the rest of the West had just stayed out of that conflict, except maybe for an American-Japanese conflict.
An entirely different world as we know it today would have occurred. And to your points on the inevitability of conflict between Germany and the Soviet Union, Quinn mentions it in his piece there for Dekel's War. You know, he does kind of say that, you know, I think he said something along the Soviets being worse than German atrocities. I don't know who's worse. I don't need to tally numbers or death tolls or anything like that. But, I mean, yeah, he kind of alludes to, you know, it's going to go down one way or another. I always kind of can't help but wonder, though, since we had so much more in common, I mean, the majority ethnicity of white Americans at the time of the war was German. None of them seemed to have any problem killing other Germans. I think Italian Americans were enlisted in disproportionate numbers as opposed to every other ethnic group in America at the time. And again, I'm sure a lot of them did, but I haven't read, you know, any massive issue of any of them steamrolling, you know, from Sicily up to Rome. There were, obviously, but I think guys like Dekel probably had a much easier time, you know, facing a total alien enemy than Christian Europeans against Christian Europeans. They seem to get over it, I guess, more or less because they had to, probably.
Well, of course, there is the whole ex post facto justification of the war with the Nuremberg moral paradigm that we have to stop this, otherwise there's going to be a Holocaust. And wherever you see nationalism cropping up, it's just a prelude to a, well, wherever you see nationalism among white people cropping up.
Yes.
It's a prelude to a Holocaust.
Great caveat.
And in a sense, I mean, because of the Nuremberg moral paradigm, we, and because of the fundamentally anti-white and xenophilic culture we live in, ironically, the Japanese, we are closer to rehabilitating wartime Japan than we are to rehabilitating Nazi, you know, National Socialist Germany. Even though what the Japanese did to prisoners of war, to occupied populations, to, but basically anyone they came in contact with was monstrous. In the Pacific and the Asian theaters of the war were simply monstrous. There was monstrous behavior on the part of the Japanese. Let's not
be wrong
to push there.
Essentially,
in, yeah.
I was going to say, I mean, that is exposed, you know, throughout historical research, and, you know, they make documentaries about it and stuff. But compared to the demonization of what happened in Europe, it's glossed over by comparison. It's really fascinating.
Exactly. I mean, and especially when you think about how comparatively fair the Germans were. Like almost everyone you speak to here in Macedonia remembers the Germans as, well, I wouldn't say fondly, but they were certainly nicer than the Bulgarians, right, who were occupying parts of Macedonia at the time, and even nicer than the Italians. They requisitioned the things they needed from the civilian population, as opposed to just outright stealing them. You know, you would actually get Reichsmarks or notes promising Reichsmarks in exchange for your stuff, which the German army took, whereas other occupying armies, including the liberating partisans, which were communists, would just straight up steal the stuff. You know, Germans engaged in no rape and murder of civilians, and this is something that's still remembered throughout Europe, that the German army conducted itself in accordance with the rules of war, that German officers conducted themselves as gentlemen. When you compare that to the absolute brutality of the Japanese and the just relative disparity of condemnation is unbelievable, right?
I mean,
and to say nothing of the absolute lack of condemnation for Allied war crimes, which were many and numerous and prodigious. You know, it's
the victors write history, though.
It is what it is. In Germany had to be demonized. Germany had to be destroyed. Mayhaps they pissed off the wrong ethnic group, but it could be one of those things, I guess. So
absolutely.
Poor old, well, I don't know his rank, so I'm just going to call him Mr. Deckel. His country is gone, and he's very sorry about it. It's just packs a massive emotional punch. I never like seeing the elders being sad or being disappointed. I think when someone is that close to checking out, we should let them go away with a smile. But then again, I'm not much inclined to smiling myself these days. It is what it is.
No, it's sad for sure.
Well, speaking of smiling, and we've been talking about war, have you had the chance to read Greg Johnson's reflection on Sorel?
I did, actually. And see, this is why I love Countercurrents, because honestly, I had no knowledge of Sorel whatsoever. Like, I haven't read him. I don't know his viewpoints or anything like that. So just reading Greg's article on the subject is obviously very educational. Essentially everything I read ever since I've learned of Countercurrents is referenced by Countercurrents, like someone writing an article on something or something in a podcast like this, they reference a book. I'm like, okay, I'll add that to the list. I got to read it. So now I got to read more Sorel. So I can't really speak, too accurately on the subject, but I did learn a lot from his article. I thought it was great.
I find that interesting, the discussion of militancy, not necessarily as violence itself, but as taking the cause so seriously that you're unwilling to compromise with its opposite or anything but the cause. So, and even to the point of being prepared for violence. So in essence, this is like putting a loaded gun on the negotiating table, not with the intention of using it, but to signal a willingness to use it. It's actually a very subtle difference which you put in negotiations, really. And let me just give you an example here. Someone commented to me that if you had, in the context of national struggles in the Balkans, right, if you had me as Prime Minister of Macedonia and whoever's running Golden Dawn as Prime Minister of Greece, counterintuitively, because both of us are quote-unquote extreme nationalists, any conflicts between Macedonia and Greece would be resolved within 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Why? Because of our militancy, of our preparedness to see conflicts as they really are, conflicts which could result in violence and extreme violence. I mean, we are talking, of course, here by state about state-on-state violence. We do not advocate for illegal activity on the writer's block. We are merely talking about policy proposals, the policy being a war to extension between Macedonia and Greece. But still, it is a policy proposal. We can still discuss those. And precisely this militancy would so increase the seriousness of negotiations that you would paradoxically reach peaceful solutions with much more alacrity, just because you've actually thought ahead and put the loaded gun on the table and proclaimed very loudly, this is one of the tools I am willing to use in pursuit of my goals. Now, is this your, does this comport with your reading of the article, Anthony, or am I just, as usual, reading too much into it?
No, I think so. And on that point alone, when it comes to militancy with a zero-sum game, you know, I feel like Sorrell hit the nail on the head, right? I mean, look at where we're at today. Maybe people aren't as militant as they could be on either sides of the spectrum, immediately resorting to violence. But I feel like this is something the left has absolutely adopted with the idea of a zero-sum game and having no problems resorting to varying degrees of violence as a goal to get what that they're desiring to achieve. I like Greg's take on, like, basically the right trying to adopt some of those policies, especially with political myth and those ideas. But what I also liked from his article was the idea that, like, it kind of breaks down the left-right paradigm, right? This, you know, Sorrell identified himself, I think, as a Marxist, but his ideas have potency just beyond that, right? He's not just pigeonholed into that one line of thought. Other people can adopt these ideas and take them in different directions. And that's what Greg was kind of advocating in his article. And I thought it was great.
Indeed. It's, we've had actually the second episode of the Reform Writers Block, after we moved it under the Countercurrents umbrella, was with Catherine S. And we discussed Sociology for the South by George Fitzhugh, right? And one of the things George Fitzhugh pointed out was that the socialist, I wouldn't call it ideology, but the socialist, the instinct of socialists was really a return to a yearning for a return to an older form of societal organization, because the liberalism of the 19th century was brutal and it left the weakest members of society completely exposed to the winds and currents of the free market. And what the socialists were yearning for was essentially a return to serfdom, a return to the state of servitude of mankind, where they were protected by a feudal lord. And Fitzhugh does not mince words. He just calls this slavery. He defends slavery in Sociology for the South. He's writing this in Antebellum America in Virginia. And I tend to agree with him. I think that the impulse for socialism is an impulse towards unfreedom, Maybe not outright being owned as a slave or a serf, but definitely most people, I would say, today would trade some of their quote-unquote much more vaunted freedom for a degree of security. And
Evola's the reality of it is... That's Evola's hierarchy, right?
Exactly. And the reality of it is we are all born fundamentally unfree. We are born as part of collectivities we have really no choice about being part of or not. And as such, because these collectivities are in conflict with other collectivities, we are thrust into life and death situations without any will of our own. Like, by the virtue of having white skin and belonging to the white race, I am an enemy of people who are anti-white. And so is, like, right this moment, there are white babies being born, and there are enemies with non-white babies being born. And these babies born in the duration of this show, and they are enemies with each other through no choice of their own. This is something we need to understand. Man is not a free creature. Man cannot be a free creature. No matter how many chains we break, we are still chained by our physical form, by our skin, by our bones, by our genes and blood and guts and other liquids. And this is there's a requirement to understand this totality of unfreedom, I guess, and the thrownness of man in the world. I was gonna talk about how essentially yellow-bellied we are in the modern West. We talked about hipsters. We talked about the unwillingness of youngsters to serve in the army. And one thing I like to, maybe to great risk to countercurrents and myself, I like to point out that at some point we're going to have to reach for the sword. At some point, there's going to have to be violence. If we want to build a white ethnostate, we're going to have to do a little ethnic cleansing. And that means forcing people to relocate, pointing a gun at someone and saying, I will shoot you if you do not comply. And some people will not comply. So really, I think people need to get it in their heads that at some point we're going to have to load a gun and put it on the negotiating table and say to the other guy, I am willing to use this. This does not mean we are going to use it, but practically speaking, yeah, there's going to be some force that's going to have to be applied. I think that Sorel really clears the air. And I guess these old thinkers really did understand these things, that when we are talking about ideology and state, we really are talking about loading a gun and saying, I am willing to use this.
It also, I mean, if it doesn't come, you know, if conflict is not a method of achieving it, it comes in the aftermath of conflict. It's much closer to your neck of the woods, so you're probably a lot more knowledgeable on it than I am, but I haven't seen a lot of English language work done on it, but I've always been fascinated by the personnel exchange in the wake of the Greco-Turkish War in the 1920s. So these are two peoples that have had a long history of not living well together. And eventually, just like you said, zero-sum game, somebody put their foot down and said, all right, enough of this shit. If you're a Turk living in a Greek island, get the fuck out. Or if you're a Greek living in Anatolia, you're going back to Greece. And this is after peoples had been there for, I mean, how many thousands of years sometimes? And that's how they fixed the problem. And obviously we're talking millions of people, not hundreds of millions. But it's been done before in history. And I'm sure that wasn't all peaceful. Not everyone got a U-Haul truck with a full tank of gas.
There is a town in northern Greece called Nea Marmara, and very few people speak Greek in it. Most of the locals speak Turkish to each other because, I mean, they speak Greek, but poorly. They speak Turkish because that's their mother tongue, because these are Turkish-speaking Greeks from the Sea of Marmara. They're Greeks, they're Orthodox, but their language is Turkish, whole town of them. And if you look at the history, both governments conspired to forcibly settle them there. They didn't want to move.
Yeah. But
there was consensus. Fuck it. We're just getting into too many conflicts with each other. Some people are going to have to lose their homes.
That's exactly. It's absolutely unavoidable. And to your point, with like, you know, the yellow bellied nature of people in the West today, I've thought about this a lot. I've even wrestled with it myself. In order to exist in modern Western society, you, to one degree or another, have to be a coward, right? Like cowardice is mandated simply to exist. If I want to eat, if I want to provide for my family, if I want to make money, I have to agree with untruths. You know, I can't say whatever I want. I can't reference bland data or truisms if the topic arises. I have to bite my tongue. And if you do that on a long enough timeline, you come to essentially just be a meek beta. I can't remember which academic did a lot of research on late stage Soviet Union propaganda. It's going to kill me. I can't remember the guy's name, but he said something to the effect of like, the Soviet Union got to the point where they weren't really trying to make you believe their propaganda. They were just trying to get you to agree with it. They didn't care if you, didn't believe it or not. But if you agree with it, you're consenting to lies. You're being a coward.
Theodore Dalrymple.
Okay, there you go.
But it's also before him, it was Václav Havel.
Okay, maybe I'm thinking of Havel. But when you're agreeing to things you know to be lies, you can only go on for so long doing that before you're just emasculated, you're torn down, and you'll consent or agree to anything at that point. And I mean, that's where we are in the West. The amount we have to be okay with, that is anathema to our being. And that's where you get just this default cowardice. It makes Sorrell's point of, and what you mentioned, putting the loaded gun on the table, it makes it seem almost impossible.
It's horrible, really. I mean, we're circling back here to the fuck up, right? I am in many ways a fuck up precisely because I couldn't find it in myself to be that coward. I mean, there's other factors why I just exited the world, the normal life, and entered full time into being a dissident content creator and writer and showrunner. But ultimately, even before I was red pilled on race and the nature of governance, right, the nature of the human animal, before any of these things happened, I would not repeat some of the lies that were served at me. I found I had a greater fealty to the truth than it's healthy for me in the modern life. And in a sense, we are dissidents. We are fuck-ups. We are unsuccessful men because we couldn't find the cowardice necessary in ourselves to be successful, right? To function in modern society. And I think it's actually cruel. I think it's evil to force men to be cowards, because men who are mortal, who are fearful, men have fear. I think it's evil to force them to embody a vice, a sin, in order to function normally, in order to belong, in order to pursue the virtue of comedy. You have to embody the vice of cowardice. That's satanic, you could say.
I agree. And that's what's happening on the daily now. It's wild.
It really is a repulsive situation. And I wish the road out is long and thorny, but I wish there was just a button which could fix anything. I would blister my thumb smashing that button.
But that's why
speaking of smashing buttons, there's the Entropy Link, people. You can ask us questions. You can send us your comments. And here we have 5 shiny American dollars from ABC. And He says, the Order of St. Anthony was a Bavarian military order founded in 1382 by Duke Albert of Bavaria. Albert, who had publicly resolved to war against the Turks, reestablished this French order in order to aid in fulfillment of his oath. Good pen name. Well, it's actually, I didn't know that. Thank you for pointing that out, ABC. Anthony, is this the genesis of your pen name?
No, it's I wrote about it a little bit in like an interview I did recently, posted on Countercurrents. I just needed a pen name, and I picked a first and last name based on my two primary ethnicities in my background, just German and Italian. I had visited Bavaria previously on vacation with my wife, and we thought it was absolutely beautiful, and I just always remembered it, and I said, okay, that's good enough. That being said, I did not know that either about the Order of St. Anthony, but I always loved reading about basically Europe's past problems with mass migration. I mean, it's underway now, but it's happened before. You know, the 700-year Reconquista, or I think it's Nicholas of Vienna. And I mean, that's how far the Ottomans, they were up to the gates of Vienna, and Nicholas's job in defending the city, or, Charles the Hammer at Tours in 700 AD, that's where they first kind of stopped the advance through Iberia. And it took until the age of Columbus when they were finally finishing up the job. So it just kind of reminds me that we have a long road ahead of us to fix some of these problems. And I guess, the Order of St. Anthony is one such example that I just learned about.
Well, it's probably the hand of God working through you. And that's a good way to conceptualize being a writer. It really lets you share the load of creating. I find that the terror of the blank page only exists because of our hubris and of our arrogance. Let the voice of God, or if you prefer, nature, just pulse through you, and you will find inspiration to create. That's been my experience. Of course, you can always help inspiration along with by taking a walk through the woods or by the river. I find that moving water gets the creative juices flowing best. But it is what it is, I guess. We need to be more humble. And we need to remember that humble though we should be, we are not alone, we're not insane, and we're not stupid. I find that our enemies trying to impart this, that we're alone, insane, and or stupid. But the reality of it is that this is a profoundly sick society, a profoundly evil society, and the fact that we stand outside of it is our credit. And I'm just glad to be here with the best that the West, that white people have to offer, fighting this battle. I wouldn't miss it for the world. It's the greatest adventure of my lifetime. And let me just recheck all of the donation slots here. And there's nothing new. So we got 5 minutes left of show, Anthony. So if you would just move towards the conclusion, say any closing remarks you might have. And how can people find you insofar as they want to consume more of your content?
I'll wrap it up with, I guess we didn't have a chance to talk about it too much yet, but I had a bone to pick with you, actually, because I was excited about doing I had planned to do a review of the book and the movie American Psycho. And then I saw your review and you beat me to the punch. I loved your article on that. That was you, right?
Yeah, I called Patrick Bateman a tranny.
That's right. That's right. I thought I was cracking up when I was reading that. So I thought that was great. But like I said, you beat me to the punch. I don't really have anywhere to follow me. I don't have any accounts or social media or anything like that under my pen name. It's kind of whatever I think of to write. And I start soliciting it. I just kind of default mostly to Countercurrents because it's what I like to read the most. I have something coming out in the White People's Quarterly, whenever their next quarterly issue debuts. I occasionally write for Man's World. I have an article on architecture, another one about Hollywood. And I have a third one coming out about Los Angeles with them. And then the last little pieces, I'm kind of working on a novel, honestly, on what we started talking about in the beginning, the dichotomy of urbanism versus the suburbs and that pull between the two. I was inspired to write it after reading Balzac's Lost Illusions, and no one writes better about Parisian city life versus the provinces than him. And then I also read, I know he has a very different view on race than most people that read Countercurrents, but E. Michael Jones's The Slaughter of Cities. And again, I had learned about that listening to Countercurrents. Someone referenced it in a podcast. Like I said, everything I read now comes from Countercurrents in one way or another. But that's what I'm working on right now. And hopefully I find a home for that when I'm complete. And that's it for the meantime.
We should have referenced that. We should have actually beaten that drum more about basically American cities being hollowed out by racial replacement and by you're just being made unlivable by diversity. Whereas you see, although you're seeing a lot of that hollowing out in Western Europe, in Eastern Europe, cities are still standing strong. They are still alive because, well, they have no diversity. And in a couple of years from now, there will be a sort of natural experiment where a lot of these cities in Eastern Ukraine, which are being pulverized by the fighting, the artillery shelling, they will be rebuilt and they will be more alive than New York or Paris or Frankfurt. And that's, I guess, the great tragedy of our civilization, that we have inflicted upon ourselves such a plague of diversity that is not comparable to a complete and utter disarticulation of the city by bombardments, including nuclear bombardments. Just look at the revitalization of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Yeah. And just look at just how impossible revitalization of Detroit genuinely is. It is what it is, I guess. Anthony, it was a wonderful almost 2 hours that we spent together. I really had a good time. I had a great time. We touched upon a lot of important things. So, and I guess this has been the Writer's Block. I'm your friend and host, Nick Gilvey, and tonight's guest was Anthony Bavaria. We were having a best month ever type show. That was the month of July in review. And I want to thank everyone who tuned in live. I want to thank everyone listening to the replay later on. I want to thank everyone who donated. You are what makes these shows and the rest of the Countercurrents organization possible. I sincerely thank you for that. I want to thank everyone who commented in the chat. It was lively tonight. Good discussions. People just pointing out facts that I didn't know. For example, they say Sorel inspired Mussolini. Well, bully for Sorel. And I guess that's it. This has been the Writer's Block. Bye-bye, people.